It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, as Pennsylvania moves closer to dispensing medical marijuana, more and more officials are calling for its legalization and taxation of marijuana as an economic generator. Plus, a look at the role of untaxed power in and around Pittsburgh. But first, it's 5:30 on the morning of October 1st, 1992. U.S. Air Flight 620 is the first to land at the brand new $1 billion Pittsburgh International Airport.
This investment that's been made out here today will repay the taxpayers over and over again with new jobs, a new tax base, and it will make Allegheny County globally competitive.
In years to come, as you look as to what the impact of this will be, it indeed will far exceed the prior two renaissances in this community, which touched Pittsburgh only.
There's 42,000 tons of steel in this facility.
They built the dream.
That's the late Allegheny County Commissioner Tom Forrester, the political driving force behind construction of Pittsburgh International, and the chief architect, Tasso Katsalas. A lot of excitement that day and the promise of a new renaissance for Pittsburgh's economy. 25 years later, a similar idea, another $1 billion plan for Pittsburgh International. Let's talk about those plans that were announced this week with Teresa Clift, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Welcome back, Teresa.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
And Jared Stonecipher is reporter for the Beaver County Times. Welcome back to you as well, Jared.
Good to be here.
And you're invited to join the conversation. Please tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. So, travelers are used to entering the landside terminal for ticketing, checking bags, going through security. Then they take the tram to the X-shaped airside terminal to board at the gates. That's going to change in the future, Teresa.
Yeah, that's right. Pretty much ever since Christina Custodis came on board as the airport CEO, she's been saying that the hub is not coming back, the U.S. Airways hub. That the airport needs to really reinvent itself as an origin and destination airport. They call that an O&D airport, because the hub isn't coming back. And a hub, as for those who don't know, is mostly used for connecting flights, whereas an origin and destination is the flyers are coming out of Pittsburgh and coming into Pittsburgh, not as much connecting. So she's been saying that, but this plan is really making that real. It's really a complete overhaul of the airport and making it more appropriate for Pittsburgh instead of for what U.S. Air needed for a hub. And that's not to say that if a hub doesn't want to come here in the future, that that's wouldn't be possible to be used still. But they say this is really fits the needs better of the airport.
Jared, some of the specifics, they're going to basically build a new land side, although it'll be right near the airside terminal, sort of between the C and D concourses?
Correct. Officials said that there was so much work that needed to be done that renovation wasn't so much an option. It would have been a lot cheaper, a lot more responsible, just redo the entire thing. There were a lot of inefficiencies at the current airport. The baggage system is outdated. The security system is not as expansive as they would like it to be. The tram that shuttles people from landside to airside and vice versa is outdated and costly. And airport officials say that this will save them about $21 million a year in operating costs to do all this. So there were plenty of reasons to do it, but a lot of it is because 1992, 25 years ago, there's been a lot of technological changes since then. There are a lot of things that the airport could do to make things more efficient for travelers and everyone involved. So I think at the end of the day, this isn't necessarily about downsizing as much as it is about modernizing.
And you'll be basically, when this happens, you'll be basically entering the airport, getting your tickets or, you know, processing, moving through, checking the baggage, and you'll be a lot closer to your gates, actually.
Right. Part of it is they're going to sort of take down a wall that's in the airside terminal that has the TJ Fridays and a couple shops, and that will become the way into the airside terminal from the landside. So they won't have the tram anymore. It'll be connected, and they think it'll be more convenient.
And
more.
Yeah, and based on what you said earlier, Teresa, they were, you know, with when U.S. Air was the hub and all that, they were so proud of having what is currently 75 gates, but those gates just aren't being used. So they're right. actually going to reduce the number of gates, I believe, to 51.
Right. So today they have 75 gates. Today they only use roughly 39. Concourse A, which is where the press conference was, just has gate after gate that's empty most of the time. So they that's, you know, less than half that they need. So they're going to be building it with 51 gates, which is still about a dozen more than they use today to allow for more flights.
I think it's important to note, too, when the airport was built in 92, it was built to accommodate about 32 million people. They never came close to reaching right. that in traffic. It was, I think it peaked at about 21 million in the late 90s.
Yeah, then, 97, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
Then the bottom fell out with U.S. Air leaving after 9/11, you know, early 2000s. Today, that's about 8.3 million. It's been steady. It is growing. But officials did say that this new landside terminal and renovations to the airside will be able to eventually accommodate about 18 million travelers with flex space up into the low 20s. So officials clearly are planning for growth moving forward, but not as much growth, not as much space that was there previously.
Yeah, that 8 million, that was quite a big drop off from that peak. But you mentioned two of the key factors, the loss of the hub and just the air travel going down after 9/11.
Right.
So, but we're getting a little bit, where we're seeing the growth that Jared alluded to, it's these smaller airlines with a few flights here, a few flights there, and that seems to be the future.
Yeah. The airport, I believe, is now up to 68 nonstop destinations, and that's about double from when Christina Katsotis came on a few years ago. So they've been, yeah, they've been adding steadily. They've got this different type of startup airline called OneJet that is geared toward business travelers that fly planes that seat about 8 people. And they've been adding, they're in a contract to add 10 flights or 10 new nonstop destinations by the end of this year. They've been, they've got Spirit on board now. They've got Discount. They've got Discount Airlines serving to vacation spots. And they're really still looking, though, to add more flights to the West Coast. And specifically right now they're looking to add one to Seattle because that would help the Amazon bid. And to, you know, London and some other places. But
well,
they're proud of
London.
The growth.
I'm sorry, Teresa. Yeah. Finish your thought, please.
Oh, no. I was just going to mention that they also they've got flights now to Germany and Iceland, but they're hoping to add more international, especially the UK.
Exactly. That's what I was going to follow up on. Well, Christina Katsotis, the authority CEO, has said she's not really pursuing, interested per se, in having a hub.
Right.
But we do have more international flights than ever, Jared.
That's correct. They're really hanging their hats on, as Teresa said earlier, becoming an origin destination, not a hub. That means taking people directly to where they want to go, Europe. Frankfurt is one of them, Iceland, and of course, they're really going to look to the future to keep expanding those kind of routes. I mean, the budget airlines are a part of that domestically, but I think a lot of their growth in the future is going to be to shuttle people to and from their destinations and not as a connector.
All right, Katsotis said at the news briefing where they announced this that the region is growing a tech-focused economy, and that's what's needed to be reflected directly at the airport.
We have to meet the changing needs of today's airlines, our passengers, the travel industry. And this is the type of forward thinking that you're going to see as we unveil this big picture project that is emblematic of where Pittsburgh is already today.
Pittsburgh has obviously reinvented itself a lot in the last couple of decades, medicine, education, technology, and officials at the airport say it's time for Pittsburgh to catch up to that. The airport has had some tough times. There's no doubting that. But Pittsburgh itself has reinvented itself, and these officials say there's no reason that the airport can't also do so.
Yeah, and you know, just talking to community members and the folks that use the airport since this announcement, a lot of them, you know, are really excited about this. Obviously, when you're announcing a $1 billion project, you're going to get, you know, some negative input as well. Some say, you know, we're already airport of the year. Why do we need to, why is this necessary? That the airport is pretty easy to fly out of compared to other big city airports. So easy, in fact, that the airport recently became the first in the country to allow non-ticketed passengers pass through security to greet folks at the gates and to shop, because their security lines are usually pretty
cut off after 9/11.
Which was cut off after 9/11. So from a passenger standpoint, it's sort of unclear how much of an improvement this will be. They say that that it will decrease the wait times at baggage and ticketing and security. Still waiting to hear back some of the data they have on that. But there's definitely a mix of emotions from the community about this announcement.
Well, Teresa, you mentioned Airport of the Year, but there were some blunt comments about the current status, the current situation involving Pittsburgh International Airport. I was curious. I was curious about a comment from Craig Davis. He's the CEO of Visit Pittsburgh. He said Tuesday the city needs a better front door.
Pittsburgh makes such a wonderful impression, and this airport is not in keeping with that impression.
So, short comment, but pretty blunt. It's like it's not reflecting what we're trying to project here.
Yeah, the airport definitely has a lot of positive features. It's aesthetically pleasing, but seeing, you know, gate after gate empty, and a lot of the shops are often empty. I mean, it's sort of a it's pretty clear that it's the wrong size for the needs currently.
Even in the past, they had to wall off certain sections because they just weren't being used. It was more economically feasible to just wall them off and just not use them. I think one of the branding that airport officials want to do, they want to say that this is an airport for Pittsburgh, not for an airline. And Casadas even said, you know, U.S. Air, they're not even around anymore. So it's time for Pittsburgh to take it upon itself to create an airport that is for the passengers and not for any one company.
Speaking of passengers, you know, you can have goals. You can say we want flights. But what is realistic on growth in passengers, the number of passengers over a project? Do they have projections over the next several years where they would like to be?
Well, I did note earlier with the current plans, they're planning for an increase of up to, it can accommodate 18 million people.
It can accommodate that.
Sure.
But how are they going to get there?
Well, Amazon would certainly be along those lines. You have the Shell facility in Beaver County. I talk to people on a weekly basis. They're flying in and out every day. There's a lot going on in Pittsburgh, and I think the airport wants to prime itself for an Amazon, something like that, that might come. So it might be optimistic, but I certainly think that it could happen in terms of reaching those numbers again.
Teresa, it seemed like leadership at this news briefing where they unveiled this $1 billion plan, we're emphasizing 3 points. Maybe there are more and you can add to them, but current airport doesn't meet passengers' needs, requirements, no tax dollars to pay for the rehab.
Local tax, yeah.
Yeah, local tax dollars. No local tax, thank you. And what's important to the airlines, which is the cost per enplaned passenger, could actually drop by $3, which is attractive to the airline industry. So how is this going to be paid for if not local tax dollars?
Yeah, so the main way they're planning to pay for this is to float bonds. The current bonds that financed the current facility that was built 25 years ago, they'll be about 75% paid off next year, Casotas told me. So shortly after that, they'll take on new bonds for 20 to 30 years. I think they'll have one for the parking garage and one for the new landside terminal. That's the main way. They're also going to get some revenue from parking and concessions at the airport and some other sources, maybe some state money as well. From gaming revenue that they get might be used. So that's sort of the plan. There's differences of opinion on whether they should be taking out another bond right after the current one expires. That's obviously, to them, they think it's worth it. So
okay, so for people who have not seen the renderings that were released Tuesday as well, what are they going to see? Is it going to be more attractive? Are there color changes, different designs?
Certainly looks a lot more modern. They have a really snazzy video on a website, a dedicated website they created just so people can go and get informed. It's called pittransform.com. The video shows computerized passengers walking through this bright, spacious concourse, and it certainly does look modern. It looks a lot better than the current facility, that's for sure.
What was your impression of the iterations?
Yeah, it definitely looked nice. At the end, she showed what it's going to look like at night, and I found that to be the most impressive part. All lit up in the new design. So it definitely got folks excited.
So the passengers are going to see some changes. How's it going to affect them? So one of the final questions I have for you, is this intended to make passenger traffic not only more meet their demands and needs, but also get the flow even better, or what? Passengers onto their flights.
Yeah, they'll have to walk. They'll have to cover less ground. They'll have to do, there'll be fewer moving walkways and escalators, fewer, just not as much space, not as much area to get through when you're getting, to your flight and off your flight and to the baggage claim.
All right. We have 1 minute left. I want to get both of your impressions. What will you two be keeping your eyes on as this project moves ahead? Jared, let's start with you.
Well, perusing social media, some people are hesitant to embrace this, but I think one of the larger problems, especially seen from comments on social media, people are still worried about how to get to the airport. Anyone who drives Parkway West on a daily basis knows it's a nightmare, even when it's not under construction. And we're in a time now where public transit is being cut, not added. So the airport's not, it's not right there. It's a bit out of town there in Moon Township. So I think some folks are worried. We're going to have this beautiful new airport. How are we going to get there?
All right, Teresa?
Right. Yeah, especially with construction right now.
It's a nightmare.
I think it's important. Now that the airport has, as you mentioned, created this website that they put all their information up, it makes it easy to track whether what they are projecting to happen is actually happening, whether the $23 million a year comes to fruition in savings and where that is going to come from. I think those are all good things to follow. Oh, also the FAA needs to approve this, which is
a minor hurdle.
And they need environmental approvals. And it's still very early in the process. They've got to hire contractors. So seeing, the FAA can be difficult to get approval sometimes for these things. So following that is important.
We'll look forward to your coverage. Teresa Clift is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Jared Stonecipher, reporter for the Beaver County Times. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Coming up, as medical marijuana gets closer to being dispensed in Pennsylvania, more officials want recreational marijuana legalized as a cash cow. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Months after the budget was due, the House narrowly passed a tax-free funding plan Wednesday. It's unclear how far it'll go. The Senate and Governor Wolf supported a very different plan that would raise taxes. And Pitt grad students are hoping to form a union. Organizers say they expect more than half of the school's grad students to pledge support and hope the Labor Relations Board will vote on the issue at the end of the semester. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Medical marijuana dispensaries are supposed to be up and running and selling medical cannabis to patients by early spring. But a seemingly growing list of politicians are thinking about the economic potential of legalizing and taxing recreational marijuana. Joining us in studio is Ben Schmidt, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Good to see you again, Ben.
Thanks for having me again.
And on the phone is Brett Schultes, reporter for the York Daily Record. Brett, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And you're invited to join the conversation. Please tweet us your comments, your questions, and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, Pennsylvania still has an unbalanced budget. Senate passed a revenue plan in July to fill a $2.2 billion hole that the House ignored. This week, along party lines, the House passed its own revenue plan, which is seemingly unlikely to make it through the Senate or pass Governor Wolf's desk. House Republicans are relying on transferring monies from accounts designated for specific areas, including transportation. The Senate plan includes new streams of revenue, not one-time fixes. Pennsylvania Auditor General Eugene DePasquale says he has an idea. The auditor thinks fully legalized marijuana, medical and recreational, could help solve the state's growing budget problems. He spoke with WESA reporter and Confluence producer Megan Harris earlier this week.
First of all, the way we're going about dealing with marijuana right now literally is nonsense. I mean, still, the idea that we're going to throw people in jail for this is crazy. Number two, just from the scientific, it's significantly less addictive than cigarettes. Three, it can actually help reduce our opioid addiction because we now know how addictive opioids can be. And for people that have pain, this is a way to deal with it. And four, it just simply makes sense. Let's bring in the tax revenue. Let's regulate it appropriately. Let's keep it out of the hands of kids. And let's improve our economy.
All right, let's get reaction to the Auditor General's argument for legalization. Ben, let's start with you, then Brett.
Okay.
All right, Ben, go ahead.
Well, I mean, the question is this a pipe dream, pun intended? The way the state treats alcohol, for example, would this actually ever happen? Would there actually be legalization of recreational marijuana? A lot of people think it's pretty far-fetched, but definitely the Auditor General is serious.
All right. And Brett.
Yeah, I mean, here we are talking about legalizing recreational marijuana. And although we're on our way as a state to having medical cannabis, that's even seeing a lot of obstacles right now. And so, you know, I think it perhaps is a little bit tentative or premature to go down that road whenever we're not necessarily seeing a clean rollout yet of the first round of medical cannabis growers.
Brett, you mentioned obstacles. Are this just implementation obstacles, maybe things that hadn't been thought about or just they were overlooked? Or are people throwing up obstacles in the way? I'm curious what you're seeing and hearing.
I think there are a few distinctly different types of obstacles, and one of them is internal, coming from some of the other grower processors who were unhappy with, or the candidates to have a grower processor site who were unhappy with the way that the licenses were rolled out so far in Pennsylvania. The state has faced criticism for having a sort of secret panel or anonymous panel of officials making the decision. And the state certainly has said that, or has emphasized that their process is objective and merit-based and not based on anything else. And they also emphasized that it was important to protect these officials from harassment or scrutiny or, the risk of bribes or anything like that by keeping them anonymous. But others have said that poses another problem, which is it prevents the public from scrutinizing them for fairness. So not merely just a critique, but also a lot of those, I think, and excuse me if my number's a little bit wrong here, but I think 140 or some filed notices or administrative actions with the state sort of protesting and wanting to see who these officials are. So that's one aspect of it. And then, of course, there are also signals from the federal government, U.S. Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, that maybe the states will get some obstacles there or some opposition there.
Ben?
Yeah, Brett's exactly right. And to piggyback on the state issue, I also believe there's already been at least one that I know of, a legal challenge in court for one of the growers, processors, candidates that was not accepted. I don't know whether that legal challenge will slow the process down, but I know one of the arguments made in the court documents is that this should be either delayed or blown up and started all over again. Now, on top of that, I've been told also from some of the candidates that were accepted that the state fully intended this for some challenges and that they're pretty certain that everything is going to be on schedule, but we really don't know.
All right. The Auditor General estimates that full legalization of marijuana in Pennsylvania would be worth at least $200 million in tax revenue a year. He says Pennsylvania should move quickly before neighboring states such as New Jersey, Maryland legalize and set up retail operations of their own. Ben, I know you've talked to the Auditor General as well. He also wrote an opinion piece for the Philly Inquirer, noting that 8 states, Alaska, California, Colorado, Maine, Massachusetts, Nevada, Oregon, and Washington, plus D.C., have legalized marijuana. Here he is again, Auditor General.
The longer we wait, the more we're going to miss out on the opportunity.
All right, so what's been the response, Ben, to the Auditor General's argument?
Well, at least in my interviews, it's pretty much down the middle, but I think polls that I've seen show that more people side with him. The question is, again, as I said earlier, is this really going to happen here? It is going to continue to happen in other states. I truly believe that.
Steve Miskin, the House Republican spokesman, had an interesting comment for you, interesting reaction, I believe, as well.
Yeah, he said something along the lines of, you know, we'll listen to him talk about fiscal things, but not when it comes to recreational marijuana legalization.
All right. So last year, Colorado, with less than half the population of Pennsylvania, Colorado brought in $129 million in tax revenue. But can you just compare, gentlemen, can you just compare population size and automatically say Pennsylvania's with population twice that of Colorado, the revenues will be twice that much? That doesn't really take into account demographics, social attitudes toward legalization. Brett, let's start with you.
Well, I think social attitudes towards legalization is part of it, and sort of the climate and brands of those states as well, you know, especially bringing up Colorado. A friend of mine recently shared a post that was an advertisement for Colorado's state lottery system. And it showed, you know, support the lottery because it'll help fund things like hiking and mountain climbing, things of that nature, recreational activity, in other words. And I think Pennsylvania, in contrast, doesn't quite have that same brand and isn't necessarily seeking that brand. At the same time, I think that, you know, we have a lot of people reaching out to find explanations for how to fix our fiscal situation. And so this is just one aspect of it.
Social attitudes. Decriminalization was passed in York. It was passed a couple years ago, I think in 14, in Philadelphia. And the councilman who was behind that was actually elected as mayor the following year. So passed in York, passed in Pittsburgh, I believe in April of last year. Yeah. So what's been the reaction? Brett, we'll start with you. What's been the reaction in York? And then Ben, we'll get you on Pittsburgh.
Well, the reaction is varied, but I think a lot of it is pretty positive. And the one thing we haven't really talked about yet is the effect on people's lives of being prosecuted for marijuana possession. And I think citing the ACLU, we know that, you know, minority communities are targeted, I think, four times more frequently for these kinds of arrests. Or charges, and that, you know, of course, having a misdemeanor or felony possession charge on your record can certainly have a long-lasting effect, negative effect. So I think that's a big part of it as well. People say there are better ways to spend police resources, and there are more important things to be focusing on crime-wise.
Ben? I think it's also been positive in Pittsburgh. I think there's definitely a consensus that police should be doing other things. Anecdotally, if you look at any news story online about a large marijuana bust and just go ahead and read the comments, I know that doesn't represent everyone, but most people say things along those lines like, couldn't the police be doing something else? Or kind of sarcastically, congratulations, you know, things like that. So I believe that there is a positive response to decriminalizing it.
Ben, I know you went to a job fair in McKeesport. This was, of course, for the medical marijuana. Was there a certain excitement about marijuana legalization as a whole, or was it strictly focused on the medical marijuana and the dispensaries?
I think there's a little bit of both. And from my perspective, you know, I showed up at that with a photographer and we were both kind of blown away by the turnout. I think the figures we were given were more than 1,000 people waited in line. I didn't count, but there were definitely hundreds of people waiting in line to, you know, get 30 jobs or so. And there was definitely excitement in McKeesport.
Okay, so we talked about these cities that have decriminalized marijuana, and that's as far as cities can go. I know that Representative Ed Gainey is proposing a resolution in the state house for a study, directing the Joint State Government Commission to establish a committee to look at legalization or decriminalization of marijuana. He said it has to be a state issue rather than municipality by municipality by municipality. But I want to get your reaction, both of you, to this. If they say, okay, decriminalization, that doesn't play into those folks, including the Auditor General, who wants to use this as an economic generator, because decriminalization wouldn't mean legalization and therefore tax dollars. Brett?
Well, there's a lot going on with that question. If marijuana is decriminalized and approved for recreational use, where's it coming from? Who's growing it? How is it being purchased? How is it being transported? And are those who are growing it for recreational purposes the same as those who are growing it, had been growing it for medical purposes? Let's keep in mind that in Pennsylvania, unlike a lot of states such as California or I believe Colorado, even under the current medical cannabis program, you're not going to see, or you certainly shouldn't legally see, marijuana in its leaf or whatever form on the street or in end users' hands. It's being, transferred into a number of products right now. So I think that asking the question of how it would roll out of the state is really one of those situations where those details is where are where the complexity will really lie there.
Okay. Ben?
Yeah, to piggyback on that, I mean, there are a lot of things. There are a lot of efforts on various fronts here. And decriminalizing, like you said, is kind of looking the other way, while legalizing in some form is a lot different. And I think the consensus, from what I've gathered in the state here, is that let's do medical first, see how that goes before we even really tackle recreational. Now, whether that happens or not, I'm not sure.
We have just about 40 seconds left, guys, so split it if you would. What will you two be keeping an eye on the decriminalization, the legalization of marijuana? Brett, let's start with you. About 20 seconds, please.
Well, I'm going to be focusing on the rollout of the medical cannabis program, how it affects end users, consumers, those who need it, as well as how doctors are going to be responding to this, because there are questions that perhaps some doctors are going to be concerned with getting involved with the medical cannabis program. There's a lot of language that sort of goes around they're not writing prescriptions, they're writing recommendations, and that'll be interesting to follow as it pans out. One final note before I turn it over, but most of the states that have moved on to recreational cannabis started off with medical cannabis. So I think that is a good point, that if we're talking about recreational, then probably medical is something that's going to have to happen fully first.
Ben?
I'm also curious to see how the medical rolls out, because we can actually see it. We can watch these buildings come up and watch how they grow and watch how the doctors give out medical marijuana cards and things along those lines. So that's something that's visible that we'll be able to watch as reporters. So that's where I'll start.
Ben Schmitz is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Brett Schultes is a reporter for the York Daily Record, who will soon be joining our sister station in Harrisburg, WITF. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up, the role, the influence of nonprofits on economic development projects in Pittsburgh. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Beatles visit the Steel City in 1964. Like in most cities around the U.S., they were met by extremely enthusiastic fans. They played to a crowd of thousands at the Civic Arena, including their hits All My Lovin', She Loves You, and A Hard Day's Night. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for September 15th, 2017.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. The impact of Pittsburgh's nonprofits is everywhere. In our economy, our development plans, in our government, nonprofits employ 1 in 5 workers in the Pittsburgh region, control at least 1/10 of its property, and in some cases amass some extreme wealth. It's a system with benefits for the city, but how much oversight is there? Joining us from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette is investigative reporter Rich Lord. Welcome back to the show, Rich. Good to have you here.
Hey, thanks much, Kevin.
You're welcome to join the conversation. Tweet us your comments, questions. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Now, before we begin, full disclosure, 90.5 WESA has received funding from several of the region's larger foundations, including Hines, Mellon, Hillman, Benter, McCune, and Grable. Rich, you wrote a series for the Post-Gazette, exploring the size and scope of the nonprofit economy here in the Pittsburgh region.
you break down the nonprofits into big givers and big doers. So let's start off with that. What's the difference?
We looked at 64 different nonprofit entities that had budgets of $100 million or more, and we decided that they really fit into two classes. The big givers, as you said, were foundations, essentially. They received money from a founder, usually an industrial titan from the glory days of Pittsburgh steel industry, or from the Heinz family, or as you know, there's a variety of different foundations that then are required to keep that money safe and give out a certain percentage of it every year. Those are the big givers. And then we also looked at 50 what are called operating nonprofits, from UPMC and Allegheny Health to Pitt and CMU, all the way down to the Pittsburgh Promise and less known nonprofits involved in things like charter schools or building affordable housing. So those are the big doers.
They're not necessarily separate. The big givers can also be big doers or not?
No, they're different by their very nature. Foundations have a different set of rules, a different set of laws, a different set of roles than operating nonprofits. They're both united by a couple of legal requirements. They're not allowed to exist to inure to the benefit of their board members. Or their founding families or anything like that. They're required to do a societal good. The foundations have to give away money. The operating nonprofits have to do things that might otherwise fall to government or that are general societal goods.
Okay. You write that nonprofits have become so ubiquitous that Pittsburghers could conceivably be born, educated, cared for, medically entertained, employed, and pampered through their golden years without ever turning to a for-profit establishment. That's quite a presence in the city and in our lives.
And, you know, that came to us by observing what we were reporting on in the news. My editor, Donna Eyring, and my team and I were looking at the things we were reporting on. The opioid crisis, the hospitals are wrestling with that. You know, healthcare in the jail I've reported on. Well, a nonprofit recently took that over. We report, of course, all the time on the Peduto administration. That administration is tied in with the foundation community in ways that may not have precedent in Pittsburgh. Public housing, charter schools, everywhere you look, nonprofits are at the center of the action right now. So we say, what are the implications of this? We've all read our history. We know that our region was dominated civically by, you know, big metals for years and years. Mm-hmm. Our region went through periods in which government worked hand in hand with big finance, like, you know, the Mellons, for instance. And now we felt we needed to tell the story of our current power structure, which is one in which the nonprofits and the foundations are right in the middle of the action. Nothing nefarious about it. But yeah. If you think back to the early days of America, you had no taxation without representation was the rallying cry. Well, what does it mean that we now have big time representation without taxation?
All right. So you mentioned Mayor Peduto, and you spoke with him about the role, the influence of the nonprofits. Let's listen to a brief audio clip.
They're the major employers in this town. They are the economic engine, and in some ways within the city, the economic rudder as well.
All right, we've heard much of that before. The numbers bear that out, you know, with the employment numbers and also the economic generator reference. But the mayor also said, quote, in some ways, the economic rudder as well. Did that pique your curiosity? Because rudder can infer directing, steering. So what did the mayor mean by rudder?
Oh, when I heard that sentence, it was one of those moments in journalism when you hear a sentence and you think, oh, that's high up in my story. You know it right away. That nailed down the hypothesis we were working on. And in the case of the Peduto administration, if you contrast that with other recent mayoral administrations, he is really at the table with the foundations and the nonprofits, as he says, every day, working on ways to advance the region in their view. Is there reason to be cautious about that approach? We think there is.
Yeah, but is that not to be expected? Because you mentioned, you know, sort of moved away from the industrial and the big business hitters were there at the table, if you would, throughout the years. But the big movers, the Eds and Meds, they're always, you know, that catchphrase is used. Isn't it logical that they are at the table and talking to the mayor, talking to city leaders?
Absolutely. There are a lot of very smart people at the Eds and Meds, very thoughtful people, and of course at the foundation community. And those are voices that right now have access to vast resources. The question is, do those voices drown out other voices that should also be at the table? And the other question is, at a time when the city continues to have budget questions and continues to negotiate with the four of the very large nonprofits, how does it do that at a time when a whole lot of what the mayor is trying to do is really intrinsically tied up with the foundations and the big nonprofits?
Do you see the increased presence having the ear of the mayor, as you said in one of your stories? Do you see that as just a natural progression of how our economy and who are the influential people in this region? Or is it just a different approach from this particular mayor?
It certainly is a different approach from the prior administration, the Ravenstahl administration. The Ravenstahl administration kind of walled itself off a little bit from the influence of the foundations. And as you know, Luke Ravenstahl tussled very publicly with the UPMC during his final years. Tom Murphy had a bit of a different approach. Tom Murphy believed that his job was to bring in jobs. And if the foundations were willing to help fund his vision, that's great, but they weren't going to come in and tell Tom Murphy how to bring in jobs. They could be, you know, helpful. They could bring ideas to the table, but they weren't going to be the rudder of the civic discourse under Tom Murphy. Under Bill Peduto, they are right there at the helm with the mayor.
Are they advising or are they telling?
I would say advising, but then the relationship between Bill Peduto and certainly the Heinz endowments and Andre Heinz is really close. You see a gentleman there, Mr. Heinz, with a global vision. He spent a lot of time all over the world. He brings a lot of ideas to the table. And he is really partnered with the mayor in a way that we hadn't seen before. The Almano site, as it's called, in Hazelwood, which is owned by foundations, is being redeveloped or is being planned along lines that really are being drafted up in the Heinz Endowments offices and with Andre Heinz's input. So it's a greater level of input than we've seen under prior mayors.
All right. I want to talk a little bit more about Del Mano and some other specific development projects. The Confluence spoke with Peggy Uten. She's the executive director of the Mayor's Center for Nonprofit Management at Robert Morris University, which, of course, is a nonprofit itself. We asked her about the influence of Pittsburgh area nonprofits and foundations, and she noted that most of the foundation's money actually stays local.
What I'm telling you is that Pittsburgh is number one in the nation in the amount of money that our foundations spend for our people, our places, and our projects.
Thoughts, Rich?
Oh, Pittsburgh has a remarkably dense foundation community. We took a look at all of the cities of similar size to Pittsburgh, all the regions of similar size, and there is none in which foundation giving per person exceeds that in Pittsburgh. If you want to find any per capita giving that's higher than Pittsburgh, you have to go to New York City. It's a remarkable asset. It also raises the question of how much should we be relying on that asset to power our economy and to be the rudder. There's certainly a place for-profit business too, both at the table when civic issues are being discussed and certainly in the economy. So there are people who worry about the extent of the reliance that Pittsburgh has on the foundation community.
But the positive side is they are investing money in the Pittsburgh community rather than sending it out so much across the country.
To a remarkable extent, the big foundations here keep their money locally. There are a couple exceptions, but that is absolutely true, yes.
Okay, you mentioned Almano. In general, the foundations, the nonprofits, are they involved in many development projects?
Not in the direct way that they're involved in the Almano project. In the case of the Almano site down in Hazelwood, the biggest undeveloped site left in the city, 178 acres, I believe, the three foundations own it. They're writing the rules. They're going to eventually pick the developer. In other cases, foundations are sort of involved, tossing in a little bit of money here and there to developments. There's been talk of foundations contributing to the terminal building in the Strip District. But now the city's Urban Redevelopment Authority is working with the foundations to write potential new rules for all the city's development subsidies, not just those that go to nonprofit developers.
One other project that you mentioned, one of your stories in this series, was Skyline Terrace. It's in the Hill District. What did it replace? And it was really pretty bad what it replaced.
Addison Terrace in the Hill District was one of the large, difficult housing, public housing communities in the city. And it was 734 units, all low-income housing, very dense, a lot of crime there. And the Housing Authority decided it needed to replace it. And in years past, you might have hit up the federal government for $100 million or $150 million, and if you got it, you might replace those units. Nowadays, things are much more complicated. The Housing Authority built a nonprofit entity to kind of be a partner with for-profit.
Allies and
Ross, that's right. Okay. And that was a partner then with for-profit companies. So about $160 million flowed through the Housing Authority, then through a nonprofit, and then to for-profit development partners in order to transform what was Addison Terrace into Skyline, which is beautiful right now, but it's a lot of money.
So what's the issue here, if you would? What are your questions about this in terms of, all right, so you have much better housing and affordable housing for the renters, but it was quite costly. So what did you really want to look at here, though?
You have an enormously complicated and expensive way now to finance and build affordable housing. What some folks in the affordable housing world wonder is, if things were not this convoluted, if there wasn't a nonprofit middleman required, if there weren't so many different layers of contractors on the other side of that, would you be able to build more units for the same price? You get 400 units for roughly $160 million. If it wasn't this convoluted, could you have a lot more housing for the same or lower price?
In our last 2 minutes, I want to talk about transparency and trust. Are there transparency issues? And is that unusual for the nonprofit sector?
Certainly, the nonprofit sector operates under a very different set of rules than government does. They are in some ways similar because they are both created to be outside of the profit motive, and therefore there are certain requirements. If you're not going to be taxed fully, you've got to disclose certain things to the world that maybe a for-profit business wouldn't. But for instance, you don't have to do public competitive bidding in the nonprofit world. You can go out and make your contracts without putting them out for bid or telling anybody who bid or what they bid. So if a nonprofit decides to enter into a deal with an entity that might have ties to its own board, I, as a reporter and anyone as the public, has a limited ability to see into that decision.
I want to quickly play a comment from Peggy Uten from Robert Morris about the trust issue.
What studies show is that people often say they distrust nonprofits, but they love their local nonprofits. So if it's your Girl Scout group or it's your community center or it's your community development organization that are the people that have the picnic in the summer, you love them, but there's a basic distrust of nonprofits.
All right, 30 seconds, Rich. Is trust the issue that we just say, okay, we just trust they'll do the goodwill?
Well, transparency is the issue. I can't see into the nonprofits and the nuts and bolts of how they spend their money. The IRS can, but the IRS has very little resources devoted to this, so it's left to projects like this to try to get at what's really going on in this huge part of the economy.
Rich Lord's investigative reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks so much, Rich.
Thank you, Kev.
And for this week, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer for the program, Tom Hurley. Production assistance from Courtney Harrell. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.